Gentlemen! Welcome to the most electrifying must-listen-to podcast in sports entertainment. Welcome to FFC. I am your host, person who runs a podcast and doesn't schedule podcast episodes to be recorded often enough, despite referring to themselves as the host of one, Damian Ellinghouse, accompanied as always by good friend and slave to my whims, Ryan Doyle.
Yo, listen.
Yeah.
Damian skips a week. He doesn't know the streets. Something, something, something. Scissor me, daddy ass.
New York! FFC has arrived!
Saw great art of JR in the acclaimed like year. And I was like, y'all, listen.
Yo, listen. There is a genuine joy that JR seems to get from the acclaimed, and it's made funnier because it's the exact type of thing you'd expect an old dude like him to be like, eh. But, you know, you do have to give JR credit. He is very good at being like, ah, I don't get it, but the kids like it, so whatever. You know, if it's over, it's over. It's all you can expect from old timers, right? If it's over, it's over. Nothing ever made sense in wrestling.
Shivani is always exuberant about that too.
Yeah, Tony, I mean, look, JR, his time in the booth probably should have come to an end a while ago, but he's got his moments, and he's still a good ambassador for them, so.
Yeah, of course, he's a legend.
But of course, you know, if only the most interesting thing happening in AEW was JR liking the acclaimed, but boy, it has just been a real doozy of a roller coaster for All Elite Wrestling and Tiny Con.
Tiny Con.
So, a few things have happened, but before we get into stuff to talk about tonight, of course, we want to give a 10 bell salute or a 16 bell salute? I always forget. 10 bell salute, right? Somebody dies.
16.
Is it 16? It's a 16 bell salute.
No, why would they ring the bell 16 times?
I don't know. They ring it a number of times.
10.
And they do
10. 10.
Okay, good. 10. A 10 bell salute to one of the most influential figures in all of professional wrestling, Kanji Inoki, aka Antonio Inoki, who passed away on October 1st, 2022, from systemic transthyretin amyloidosis, which is a disease that typically affects the heart and tendons of elderly people. Inoki is a figure that, you know, doesn't require much explanation, but, you know, for anybody not fully familiar, Antonio Inoki is, of course, one half of the two most famous proteges of Riki Dozan, arguably the most important Japanese wrestling figure, Inoki and Giant Baba, going on to form New Japan Pro Wrestling and All Japan Pro Wrestling alike. Inoki forming New Japan in 1972, going on to be, of course, in New Japan, one of the more prolific wrestlers in its history, but more well known as like a true ambassador of the sport, even as his influence became somewhat in question in the, you know, early to mid 2000s. Inoki, of course, the first proper IWGP heavyweight champion, although interestingly enough, only won it one time, won the original version twice, but that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, that seems like what Cody wanted to do.
Who?
Cody.
Who's that?
You know, your favorite wrestler, dude.
I don't know that. I don't know that person.
Cody-san.
But anyway, I don't know who that is. But Inoki Technically, Inoki got fired from Japan, the Japan Pro Wrestling Alliance, because he tried to take it over, which is very Inoki. And, you know, quickly had like a burgeoning rivalry with, you know, everybody from like Carl Gotch to Vader to even Hulk Hogan. Inoki, of course, to the wider wrestling world, was most well known when he fought in arguably the first ever MMA match, Muhammad Ali.
Yeah, it's pretty crazy, man. Like, it took... I always knew about it, clearly. I think we both covered it, but like it took his eulogy and Dave Meltzer speaking about how like revolutionary that match was.
Yeah, it's quite literally often considered like the birth of proper mixed martial arts, and it came as a result of Antonio Inoki wanting to prove that professional wrestling was as legitimate a sport as boxing or anything else, which you gotta admire the gumption to try to parade around a fake form of sports entertainment to the masses. But, you know, Inoki was legitimately, if not prophetic, like, he was taught catch wrestling by Carl Gotch. And so this was meant to be, like, a true joining of the two.
Right.
Of course, in our episode, what ended up actually happening is Antonio Inoki scuttled on his back like a crab and kicked the shit out of Muhammad Ali's legs for an hour until Muhammad Ali ended up retiring because of it.
Wasn't he, like, wearing copper tipped boots or some shit,
too? He wasn't doing very nice things. And
you know, it's also, I don't know if you're going to cover this, but unbeknownst to me, Inoki spent time in Brazil.
Well, so that's the thing about Inoki, right, is he's been everywhere.
Right.
Notably, you know, he was a politician in Japan. He was a member of the House of Counselors. And probably most, there are two, like, notable things that happened there. One is that he successfully negotiated with Saddam Hussein to release Japanese hostages right before the outbreak of the Gulf War.
Amazing, like, story.
Like, that's legitimately, like, Antonio Inoki did that. And he was kind of a rare breed in Japan because he attempted to forge relations with North Korea, like, pretty seriously. That, of course, is a big deal because Japan and Korea have extremely, extremely, complicated relationships with one another, and North Korea is very often flying missiles over Japan's head. So it got him a little bit of flack, but that kind of was Inoki, and in many ways a trailblazer and a politician to the bitter end.
Took a very anything will work pal approach to life, you know? I feel like only a wrestler will know that sense of what to do. Doesn't matter who, doesn't matter where. We'll make it work. We'll get it done.
Yeah.
And, you know, he even converted to Islam in order to save those hostages. He kind of reneged on it a little bit, but, I mean, the fact that, like, he went through that process, he committed to the bit just enough. It's funny that, you know, Saddam was a mark enough. He didn't get all the hostages, though. He was like, oh, you know, maybe if you bought Hulk Hogan, I'll give you all the wrestlers.
Yes, he was bestowed the moniker Muhammad Hussein Inoki, but then was like, I'm kind of more of a Buddhist.
More right.
Inoki is also probably one of the more immediately recognizable wrestlers in the world. The Great Chin may as well have been the inspiration for the Crimson Chin. That thing was made out of fucking steel.
Even to the end.
Yeah. Interesting
strict anime
guy.
Character, dude. Amazing.
Yeah, very much so. Very much so. He also, like, probably should be considered, like, a WWF champion. But Hisashi Shinma was like, no, we're not doing that. Because he, like, he beat Bob Backlund in Japan, but Tigerjeet Singh interfered, and he was like, no, doesn't count.
So Man, imagine Inoki in like Vince Senior's WWF. He would definitely gotten the strap. I don't know if he would have beaten like Bruno, but
yeah, I mean, look, beating Bob Backlund, even if it is in Japan, like big deal. You know, this is, we're talking 1979, a year into Backlund's like 5-year reign. You know, easy to forget that Bob Backlund was, you know, as over as any person of his day.
Oh yeah.
No small thing. Unfortunately, you know, his legacy in New Japan, like I said, a little marred a little bit because as his tenure went on, his booking got a little more questionable. Inokiism took over. His love for MMA started kind of infecting the promotion in a myriad of ways that really kind of almost killed it before, you know, he was fired. And, you know, Hiroshi Tanahashi and Shinsuke Nakamura and, ironically enough, Katsuyori Shibata, who may as well be Inoki Jr., helped revitalize it. But after his death, I think he was named like eternal, like commissioner of some form. So like that's cool.
You know, I wonder if he was a decade too soon. Not that like he probably would have executed it in a better way, but with the popularity that MMA had in like the late aughts and early 2000s, like, you know, it was like when it was really like sky high, I wonder if that would have translated better. Because, you know, Pride was huge, but Pride had like a lot of shady background, like the Yakuza and stuff like that. I mean, that's not, you know, the Mafia has a rich history in boxing and American, for example, but I wonder, you know, if that would have been more palatable in that era. I suppose it's still limited to Japan, but, you know, it, as much as people shit on that era, he kind of had a foresight to some things. It probably would have been better served if he just did his own league. But, I mean, yeah, you know, with the mix of Brock Lesnar and all those other guys that came into WWE, it was a little bit of foreshadowing.
Yeah, he tried, you know, he tried with the Inoki Genome Federation when Brock Lesnar like left New Japan with the IWGP Heavyweight Championship and then kind of created that weird lineage for a little bit. But yeah, I feel like the problem with Inoki's booking of New Japan and his vision was ultimately that it's hard to place what the right time would have been to try to like, there were, it's not, the issue was not necessarily making it more MMA, because you know, Japanese wrestling has like a rich history with introducing MMA in general. So it's not exactly like it came out of left field. You know, Minoru Suzuki, for example, co-founded Pancrase, which was one of the first MMA organizations in the world. You know, and in general, like, shoot fighting was worked into a lot of aspects of Japanese wrestling. So he was a trailblazer, but I think he tried to stick to his guns in ways that ultimately was not helpful for the company, because after like Hashimoto died and as Muda starts getting older, and, you know, Muda and Chono and, you know, Fujinami is already retired. Like once that old guard disappeared, he kind of leaned too heavily in with the Scott Nortons, and the Bob Sapps of the world. No disrespect to Scott Norton, like Bob Sapp was probably the bigger issue there. But, you know, ultimately, I'm sad that it needed his death to come to it. But I am glad that he can maybe be recognized or revered a little bit more in New Japan for being its founder. Because he kind of was in this weird place for a while where he didn't really get mentioned. And it is bitterly ironic that he passes in the 50th anniversary celebration of New Japan. Right. So, and of course, this now means that, you know, the three biggest figures in Japanese wrestling are now officially relegated to the history books. So, hopefully time will be as kind to him as it has been to Riki Dozan and Giant Baba. Although all three of them had quite a bit of interpersonal problems, but we don't talk about that.
The only thing I really want to mention with Riki Dozan is, can you trace back, you know, a tragic event, of course, but can you trace back something that changed the course of wrestling like that?
What, Ricky Dozan's, like, death? Or
his death, and it made, in one way or another, made Baba and Inoki to create the two legendary federations of Japan. Like, imagine, like, what would the landscape be if Ricky Dozan didn't die, you know? I imagine that Inoki probably would have eventually done his own thing. It seemed like he was destined to do that.
Yeah, same with him and Baba, but 100%, like, hard to know. You know, Ricky Dozan gets stabbed, ultimately dies in 1963, a full, 8-9 years before Inoki starts New Japan. And I think Baba started All Japan in the same year, if memory serves.
Yep.
1972, same year. So, yeah, it definitely, at the end of the day, all three of them are legendary in their respective ways because of just how unique, like, Puro Resu is to the larger wrestling world, and how innovative in a lot of ways it is, and how inspirational it's been to so many American stars and so many gaijin in general, you know, all around the world. So, we don't necessarily, we don't mourn a tragedy, right, for a 79-year-old kind of living his life out, but nonetheless a sad day, and you know, we want to give a heartfelt salute to the Iron Chin himself.
Nobody will reach the galactic level of popularity that Inoki had. Like, maybe Hulk Hogan, maybe Ric Flair. That's it. In terms of recognizability. So, you know.
I would say that, like, if you, with no disrespect to any of the many stars that have ever come through All Japan or New Japan, I think, like, in New Japan, I'm not sure you'd necessarily put anybody on Inoki's level in that regard, aside from maybe Tanahashi, who is legitimately, like, beloved the world over. Like, there's a reason he's still at the top of the card. But yeah, it's a short list of people that recognizable to a wider audience who did that much to, like, change the general landscape. And I think it's definitely fair to put him on that Mount Rushmore of, you know, top tippy top guys.
Right.
And he faced both of them in his career, you know, and beat both of them. I wonder what the list is of people that went clean over both Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair, like, in their primes. That has to be a short list.
Yeah, like pre-WCW.
Like, somebody that worked the territories or worked AWA and worked W and, like, went over both of them clean. I'm not sure that I can necessarily think of anyone.
That is a great question, Damien. You know what? Let's call our friend Jim Cornette. Hold on 1 second. Hey, Jim. Yeah, I'm recording. Oh, okay. All right. He told
what
me.
What did Corny have to say?
He said, you are slicker than coming a gold tooth, and we should die.
Oh. Okay. Well, that's fair. That's fair. We'll get him later. We'll ask him then.
Okay.
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not sure I can think of any person that, like, I'm sure there has to be people, but I'm having a hard time thinking of anybody.
Yeah.
Just because, like, Hogan happened to wrestle in Japan and Ric Flair and him had this fucking match at Collision in Korea, in North Korea. Like,
yeah, I mean, I know Hogan had his own separate run in Japan, but you would have to think of somebody that interacted both in Hogan's territory and, of course, NWA, and then in Japan.
Yeah, like, Collision in Korea, I think, is 1990. Hogan's run is, like, the late, I don't think it's the late 70s, I think it's, like, the early 80s.
Like, 82 like, to 90. 80,
yeah, 82, something like that. Short list. And that goes to show you the, like, power of him. It did happen in Japan and Korea, but nonetheless, like,
Harley Race? Did Harley Race face Inoki?
That's an excellent question.
We'll have to study this further. We'll have an update on the next episode.
Face Dory Funk.
That'd be cool if Terry Funk defeated all three.
Yeah, maybe that's the only person I can think of, the Eternal Funk. With that said and out of the way, it's been about a good 3 to 4 weeks since the last time you've heard from us, right? And so in that time, we had Grand Slam and Extreme Rules happen. Here's the thing, you know, I hate to say it, WWE's got all the momentum right now. If you're talking strictly, like, at this point, WWE's starting to hit creatively more often than they're not. And Extreme Rules felt like this really perfect encapsulation of the subtle and not so subtle ways in which, like, Triple H's creative direction has started to come to fruition. And not for nothing, not that I'm, you know, I'm not watching, I don't know if you are, but from all reports, NXT is really starting to thrive under Shawn Michaels as well. And as these call-ups, you know, Carmelo Hayes or Bron Breakker or D'Angelo start to, like, show up on the main roster.
Yeah, they're really putting the foot to the gas pedal. You can really see it. I sent you a clip last night of just this awesome interaction in a match where someone gets thrown on top of the ropes and then clotheslined. Did you see that?
Mm-hmm.
But they're really focusing on, you know, someone asked Shawn Michaels today of when does he see NXT being able to sell out arenas, stuff like that. He's like, look, we're at square one right now. I'm paraphrasing here. I am focused on just getting these guys to their day one of being over. And I partially agree with him. They're kind of like at the NXT revolution part of it. And mm-hmm. kind of like in a way, the big atmosphere that NXT was able to harbor, which was amazing in its own right, kind of hurt them in a little bit, I feel, you know? Just because WWE at the time was just like, oh my God, just give us something that, you know, NXT was able to give us this appetite that we wanted.
Yeah.
But like, you know, it's like anything got over because the crowd was just that hot for that. You know what I mean?
And with no disrespect to Full Sail or Black and Gold, but like, in many ways, it was kind of just like you were watching Ring of Honor PWG with WWE level production.
Right. It's an old studio show, and it executes its formula so much better in that environment than it would week to week as, like, you know, the opening show for a Raw or SmackDown.
I think something that made 2.0 suffer, like, yeah, ultimately, I think it's still been accomplishing its goal. And I understood the need for, like, NXT to rebrand itself in that way because Black and Gold is a very, very specific, like, feel that WWE probably was ultimately best served trying to modify more into what it wants, right? Because for better or for worse, with WWE running a product that felt, you know, with WWE running a product that ultimately felt like what then AEW felt like, it was no longer helpful to them. All of those people that they would have kept trying to vulture were going to over to AEW or, you know, going up to the main roster. So they needed a hard rebrand. But, you know, the, like, goofy, colorful shit did belie that, like, it created some, like, pretty unique or pretty interesting characters. And I gotta say, I'm pretty impressed with, like, what Shawn Michaels has now been able to do, and, you know, as Triple H moved on from it. I don't know when I'll necessarily, like, I know when Worlds Collide happened, like, recently, and I don't know necessarily when the next time I'll, like, check in mm-hmm. is, but, you know, I keep my ear to the ground, but
Probably Survivor Series, whatever they do that weekend.
Yeah, like, if they, like, get NXT people involved again, which I loved, and I do hope that they continue doing that. Yeah, maybe that's when I'll start, like, checking in again.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and it's weird because, right, the last time we spoke to everybody, we just were finding out about the details between CM Punk and the Elite and this fucking goddamn train wreck of an ending to CM Punk's likely wrestling career and, you know, all of this public shit. And then AEW just faced this torrent of leaks left, right, and center. You've got Andrade out here punching out Sammy Guevara, which, like, fair play, but also not great to play out.
He's just trying to get fired.
He's really trying to get fired. Look, we said it. We've been saying it for like a year and plus now. Like, the honeymoon's been over, and what the last couple of weeks, what the last like couple of months have shown us is that AEW, all right, it is hardly in the ground, right? It doesn't have a foot in the grave here, right? It's the tales of its demise mm-hmm. are greatly exaggerated, right? All reports suggest the network's perfectly happy with what they're doing. I think it's bringing in money, but there have been ticket sale issues and there's been some booking questions. And I think what we're learning here is, A, as eventually expected, the roster is now at a point where it is a little unmanageable. And B, Tony Khan has outed himself as somebody that cannot run that locker room, at least by himself.
Definitely
just,
not by
just
himself.
Just point blank, he can't. He just can't. He is fortunate in that he has people, bad person, outstanding locker room person, Chris Jericho, and Moxley and Danielson, who by all accounts helped kind of like bring back that rah-rah feeling of like, let's get this together, because Kenny doesn't seem like he's up for that role. Punk certainly was not up for that role. But aside from like having those important locker room leaders, it's clear that he needs other people involved in this process. Like, it just is what it is.
To help
and
him
that's
out,
with,
you know, like, don't, you can't do it.
Not here to tell you who that should be. Like, look, you got like Dean Malenko and Pat Buck and Christopher Daniels there. It's not like you don't have people that can help, but obviously Tony Khan's particular management style is now like a little bit caving in on itself, and, you know, the inmates are running the asylum, and it's you got to get that together.
I think it was important for him to establish what he wanted with the show. I think he's done that 10 times over, despite what we say about him. And now he needs to let other people take his ideas, take his like direction of the show, what he wants to do with it, and, you know, let it play out. Pat Buck, Dean Malenko, all great guys. I would go after Lance Storm. You know,
absolutely. I feel like I almost like, is Lance Storm just maybe not interested? Because I have to imagine, like, if why else would he not be there?
Maybe he just wasn't asked. You know,
I feel like someone like Lance Storm, like, I don't know to what degree Jake Roberts is still involved, because like then he had his health issues, and now we just kind of don't know. Same thing with DDP, but. Mm-hmm.
DDP definitely
people,
just didn't want to do it. I think he just wanted that little run, a nice little goodbye, and then I'm going to make my millions on yoga and change the world.
I feel you, yeah. Either way, I think what's clear is Tony Khan needed and needs to get control of the locker room, and how he does that, I don't know how to run a fucking wrestling business. I'm not here to tell you how. It's just obviously painfully clear from what has happened over the last couple of months that this ain't right. Working for him.
And now he has to deal with, you know, the elite, and we were here since day one. We helped you do this thing. Like, despite what you want to say, like, as we covered last week, you can't get rid of them, so... Plus, but if you're a non-elite wrestler and it's just like, oh, cool, these guys are the VPs and they won the Trios title. Oh, cool, the friend of the VP and in the Elite won the Owen Hart tournament. Like, you know what I mean? I'm not saying mm-hmm. like that should have been like they're excluded from winning belts, but, you know, you want a non-discriminatory environment. Am I using the right word there? Non-discretionary environment.
Yeah, I mean, look, they all kept the belts off of themselves to such a degree that people were annoyed at them. So, but I think to your point, the larger issue here is if you're going to be the stars, you're going to be the stars, right? You mm-hmm. do your politic and it is what it is. But obviously, those EVP roles should not have lasted as long as they did. It made sense maybe in the immediate, like, okay, you're establishing this company, and again, we don't know these people, we don't know anything about anything, but it does seem like from what has leaked out, like, Kenny clearly is not really the locker room leader that maybe he thought he was or that they wanted him to be. I've not heard anything bad about the Bucks, but it's more just that, like, it's hard to have active wrestlers and stars also be, like, involved in the business aspect of the company because you ultimately get a conflict of interest. Like, that is the nature of working in a business where you are constantly working for yourself. You are your own business entity, and you're also trying to reflect the interests of a separate corporate conglomerate. Like, it just doesn't work.
Not only that, when you start getting guys like Moxley and Miro and Brian Danielson. See, I didn't name one person there.
There you go.
Do they really need, like, they don't need to be directed on a match. Like, you know what I mean? It was perfect Moxley, for guys who had never been on a national program before, all these indie wrestlers that have never been on a national scale. That I get. But, you know, it's kind of like, the more and more guys you get in there, the less input you're going to have as an EVP. So, you
know what's really the point? And also, Kenny proved pretty quickly that, like, something was not going to work because he really tried to hype up his involvement in, like, the women's division. And if that is Kenny's work, then boo.
Yeah.
Boo. You did bad. You did a straight up bad job.
And also, don't feel the need to put a name on it. You know, a lot of the greatest coaches, like, for example, in baseball, weren't the best players. You know, rarely you have, like, you know, the person with the most hits in history become a coach. Usually it's like the utility guys and, you know, the guys who not necessarily had big stats, but were playing for 12 years. You know what I mean?
And very much vice versa. That is apparent throughout, like, every major sport. So often, the greatest of the greats make terrible fucking coaches or terrible executives.
Right.
Because, and if you want to make that comparison, like, let's make a comparison to, say, Kenny Omega being, like, a coach and Michael Jordan or Wayne Gretzky being coaches. Kenny obviously expects people to be able to just do a thing that he can do or, like, get it. And when you're at that level of talent, not everybody, it's not easy to teach people, because for people like say Wayne Gretzky was a notoriously bad coach because he would expect people to just be where the puck was gonna be five steps before because that's what he did, not realizing that the reason he did that is because he was a fucking savant. Like,
that's a great point too. Not that, you know, Omega or the Bucks had to come up to a certain point, but they also don't know, how am I gonna explain this? Like,
maybe exactly, they don't know how to teach people how to put together a match because they know how to put together a match for themselves.
Exactly, but like Wayne Gretzky knowing the intricacies of playing hockey that only 0.00001% of people know in the history of hockey, they're not going to know like what the fourth liner guys have to do, you know what I mean? Just to scrap and stuff like that, what would work best for them as opposed to just for an elite person.
Exactly. But that was the exact same thing with like Michael Jordan and like famously how he came down on Kwame Brown, who was by all metrics like a talented, good young player, but there was an expectation that like, why don't you just get that? It's why, frankly, Kobe Bryant was like a notoriously shitty fucking teammate and rapist. Same thing, you know? When you're at that level of talent, it's not always easy to relate to the people that don't have the same level of prodigiousness or don't have the same skill set as you. And ultimately, there are some people that are good at it and some people that aren't. Most of the time, like you said, like the best coaches that used to be players were like role players that understood that everybody has a role to play and everybody plays to their strengths. So, you mentioned,
Like TJ Wilson right now is probably one of the most over, producers in WWE. I'm not sure if he's still doing it, but I know D-Von was really revered. And then, you know, you can have your guys like Doot. Skipping.
What?
You know.
Like doot.
What? What's fucking
Nardwar? Nardwar. We're talking about Nardwar?
No, fucking Freebirds.
Oh, Michael P.S. Hayes.
There you go. Sorry. Yeah. Jesus Christ. I'm supposed to be the history guy.
It's okay. Yeah. Sometimes I know things.
You know, he knew like how to get over. TJ Wilson knows how to like fucking, I'm going to take the dungeon fucking training that I got. And this is how you do good mat wrestling. Like, you know, you want people to put different elements of their craft into a match. And maybe just being at the top isn't good enough, you know?
People like Pat Buck, for example, who like had a very successful run as a producer in WWE, is a perfect example. Pat Buck was not the Rock levels of success. Like, he's a guy that knows skill sets, so he knows wrestling, and so there's a reason why, like, create a pro, why Pat Buck and Brian Myers are so successful right now in churning out these superstars, because it's not to like discredit them for being talented in their own right, but sometimes elite levels of talent does not translate. But then, you mentioned earlier, Moxley. Moxley is that guy in AEW who, like, because Moxley, he's not somebody that you would say is, like, absurdly, like, he's not absurdly talented. He gets wrestling. The reason he's at the top of his craft, the reason why he's a top guy, is because Jon Moxley understands himself. And, like, by understanding what his character is supposed to be, he also understands, like, hey, this is how you can get the most out of something. This is how you can, like, mm-hmm. be who you are trying to be. And Chris Jericho, right, with how often he's been able to reinvent himself, is another one of those locker room guys where, like, in his case, that's a mixture of elite talent, but also an understanding that sometimes you got to change things up and play different roles. Bryan Danielson as well, somebody that has done so much over his career, that it sometimes takes a level of selflessness mm-hmm. to be able to work in that role.
And the three of them have just been absolutely astounding in the last couple of weeks by just keeping right the ship if Tony isn't, you know?
Yeah.
But again, it goes to a point, like, you know, I'm not sure if Moxley is a set person. I'm sure he's not. But I mean, like, imagine being Moxley and like someone comes up to you as a VP and just like, hey, I took some notes on how you should do this match. It's like, okay, like, what do you have to say to me?
Yeah.
But then the element of being a VP is lost, because then what's the point, you know? It's the boys running the show. You can't have it. You got to be a little more professional than that.
There's a difference between, like, and, like, Jericho walks that line a little bit of, like, this is my company, but also, like, a wrestler. But that's, like, Jericho, right?
Mm-hmm.
Tony Khan, the things that he did right in this situation is he had a situation where he was forced to suspend literally CM Punk and, like, the Elite, who just won these brand new big deal trios titles, and, like, it's Kenny Omega and the Young Bucks, right?
Right.
And this was a moment where everything went topsy-fucking-turvy.
Mm-hmm.
And in spite of the backstage drama, right, to bring this to a creative head, right, before we go back into WWE, from a, like, creative standpoint, AEW has actually been remarkably good since this. Like, Grand Slam wasn't, like, a total hit, but there were a few things that, like, the matches were really good, but it was kind of presumed that, okay, so, like, I guess Danielson will take the belt from Moxley, and instead, Tony Khan did something surprising, and he said, Jon Moxley is the guy. Jon Moxley goes out after all this. He cuts a fucking incredible locker room building promo. MJF comes back out, you know. And what ultimately ends up happening is the reintroduction of MJF, who feels absolutely revitalized in every way. Bringing Hangman back into the fold and feeling like a big deal. Running Danielson and Moxley and giving the belt to Moxley and going, here are the fucking people that matter, right? Putting the belt, like putting the Ring of Honor title on Jericho, an interesting choice, but if you're trying to like vie for Ring of Honor to get a TV deal, well, you know what? Look, I fucking adore Claudio. Jericho's probably the guy you put the belt on if that's what you're trying to do. He's got the most name recognition. He's the guy that knows the networks. Like that's probably what you do. And look, I calls it as I sees it. Jericho's been absolutely incredible for the last year now.
It's amazing, dude. It's unbelievable what he's doing. This is arguably rivaling his last decade of work.
It doesn't bring me great joy to praise this objectively not excellent person, but he is putting in the fucking work. And our big issue with Jericho at points in AEW was like, he's fucking dominating the show and he looks like shit and he's like, it's like entertaining, but it's not really working. But man, I can't complain. Everything he's done since he's trimmed down, like he's on the run of a fucking lifetime. And this is like the fifth time I've said that about Chris Jericho.
Yeah.
He very well might be the GOAT. I don't know. At this point, like it's starting to get really hard to think of who else has been this big for this long and felt fresh. Like there is no reason that I should, there's no reason that Chris Jericho at like 51 or however old is Ring of Honor champion. And I should be like, oh, okay. I get it. Like that shouldn't be how I feel. And yet here we are.
Also just like a perfect, like beatable person and individual that the Ring of Honor guys will really heed the call to get that belt back from.
And I do think that doing this run of Jericho takes on all of the like biggest Ring of Honor world champions of the past is a good way to like reestablish the belt. Because, and again, this is no disrespect to Claudio at all, because it's more just about where Ring of Honor is right now. It's in a weird state of flux. So Claudio being Ring of Honor champion didn't necessarily feel like the really cool big thing that it should have. And I'm not necessarily saying it's great that Jericho is getting this much feature on Dynamite when there's so much else to do. But again, you're trying to like really push for Ring of Honor to get a TV product. You know what? Put Jericho against Danielson and Samoa Joe and Adam Cole and like go fucking do that. And yeah, I get it. It works, you know? So creatively, Tony Khan has hit some, I won't even call them home runs. Tony Khan has hit solid double after double, which is what AEW needs right now.
They just need
AEW
to get that average
needs
up,
stability.
Baby.
It needs consistency.
They hit the home runs already. They just need to get that average up. And by all accounts, they didn't lose much viewership. They still maintain that $1 million.
Oh, they're doing good. They're doing good right now.
$1 million person viewing. And you know what? I think we might look back at this time like maybe they needed it a little bit to get those mid-tier guys up to the top level with, you know? Obviously, the shows need the elite. Not saying that, but you know, I think that we've always been saying that is that mid tier needs to be just not top, middle, and bottom. They need to have distinctions in between as well.
There's got to be some fluctuation, and you're starting to see people like Hangman and Danielson and Jericho like start kind of moving throughout the top of the card in the middle, and that's exactly what you need. Having Chris Jericho hold what is currently a mid-card title like the Ring of Honor Championship and, you know, facing top-tier talent, mid-card talent, that helps elevate it. Giving the tag titles to the Acclaimed and, you know, I won't say righting the wrong. Like, I think if you had called an audible and had them win against Swerve and Our Glory at Grand Slam, like, that would have been cool. But ultimately, they got their moment. They're over as fuck, and they need that right now. It seems that basically what AEW is doing is it's going, okay, we made some mistakes here. We need to start remembering the people that helped bring this company up and like who we want to build around. And that's why putting the title on Moxley, getting ready to hand it over to MJF, you know, making sure that Jungle Boy Jack Perry is like getting character work and getting featured more often, making sure that people like the Acclaimed are the tag teams that you're featuring. All of these things are really important for AEW's identity. And MJF's title reign, would it have been perfect getting it off of CM Punk? Sure, but him and Moxley have great history. Things are heating up. We're going to get Hangman and Mox before that. And I think that putting the title on MJF, probably at, is it All Out that's next or is it Full Gear that's next?
Full Gear.
Putting it likely on him at Full Gear is the right move. MJF is piping hot. And I think that the belt desperately needs stability.
Mm-hmm.
And Danielson deserves a proper run. Moxley, as he has described himself, Moxley is the ace of AEW. Him being a transitional champion does not matter at all. It takes nothing from him. He's literally been pinned clean twice in his entire career, like at AEW. So, you know, I think that the belt desperately needs stability. And I think a long, lengthy heel championship reign by a fucking ascendant MJF is just what the doctor ordered.
Has to be clean, too. I don't want no fuckery.
Because it's MJF, like, fine. But I agree that, like, it will feel more meaningful. I would rather see MJF play mind games like what he's been doing more recently. Like, he looks fucking jacked to the gills.
Dude, holy shit.
He gained, like, 20 pounds of muscle. Like, yeah. Like, I want to see MJF beat the shit out of Moxley, get that belt, and then let's go. You know, ramp it up.
Yep.
And all of this, of course, is in the context of, because whether AEW wants it or not, everything is in the spotlight of, well, what's WWE doing? And it brings me great pain to say these words on air.
Say it, damn it.
But, like, do I need to start watching Monday Night Raw now? Like, because, boy, I tell you, it sounds pretty fucking good.
I think pay-per-views are definitely back in play now.
100%. And so let's talk about Extreme Rules here, right? Extreme Rules extremely ruled. That was just a good, fucking well-structured pay-per-view. Storylines interweaving with each other, moving in meaningful ways. And I don't really got complaints about it. I think maybe the biggest complaint I have is that I don't think WWE ever did a particularly good job of establishing Liv Morgan as, like, a champion that I should care about. Maybe that's because I just don't watch WWE as much, because it does seem like she had, like, a certain connection with the crowd, but I don't know. Felt like they were going for, like, scrappy babyface everyone loves, and I just don't think it ever translated to, like, champion who deserves to be champion.
Yeah, I don't know how much of that is on her, too, you know? I'm
never blown away by her. I'm not, like, and I don't want to, like, I don't want that to come across as, like, Liv Morgan is a bad wrestler.
Not at
she's
all.
Not, and she she's just improved. She's improved, but
she just doesn't have that
sure.
discernible trait yet, you know?
Yeah, I'm not sure. And, like, even her character work, not currently in a place where I feel like it was good enough to be in the main event. And the feud with Ronda felt weird. I thought it was cool. You know, she gets to say she's the only woman that's ever pinned Ronda Rousey twice. That's a thing that she gets to say. And mm-hmm. that's true forever. And that's cool. But I don't know. I feel like instead of making that, like, sure, Ronda turned heel as a result, but it's not like she broke her. It's just like Ronda got sick of it. They didn't, if they wanted Liv to be this, like, Harley Quinn-esque type that they're obviously trying to go for now, then she should have gotten more in Ronda's head and, like, felt like a challenge. And it just feels like she didn't ever get to that point.
Right, exactly. You know, have her be not like a psychopath, but have her, like, be the mind games wrestler, you know?
Have her be something more interesting.
Right, exactly. That's all it really came down to. She was also caught in that weird transition between Vince and Triple H, so
yeah.
Let's see what if they're able to do something more. You know,
it looks
now,
like, so
she got something taken away from her, right? So maybe the drive to get it back is going to cause her to achieve different levels in her personality.
Reports and videos that surfaced afterwards showed that Liv Morgan, and they showed this on, she passed out, tapped out Ronda's champion again, and commentary Corey Graves specifically was like, she's kind of smiling as she passed out. And then apparently afterwards, she just sat in the ring like laughing to herself. So clearly they're going for some sort of like, oh, she's lost her mind type deal. And I guess we'll see what happens with that. But and I won't even call the match a dud. It just was a little bit like it felt eh. But opening up with the Brawling Brutes Imperium, which has been just a really good, very simple story. I feel like WWE's a little bit excelling at the simple story right now. And I feel like they need that. I feel like they need simple stories that work right now, because WWE, you know, they either do these like weird, hyper complex stories that just meander and never go anywhere, or they're stories that just never fucking end and nothing's interesting about it. But Brawling Brutes Imperium is a really great example of like the right people won, and those are just people with great chemistry. And you've made me somehow not angry that Pete Dunne is Butch. Like, you know, I'm content with it. Do we think Sheamus ultimately wins the belt off of Gunther? Do we think that's where this leads?
You know what it is? I think they really achieved a level where people would be okay with it. I don't think it needs to be this massive run that we originally planned, that Gunther has to carry it all the way to WrestleMania. Maybe that's what you do eventually with Sheamus. You know, let him get out of the scene a little bit. Let him continue kicking ass. And then win it off Gunther there. But dude, he deserves it 100%. You want to talk about someone having a run? We covered it again last episode, but even more affirmed in the last pay-per-view too. So, like, how do you feel about that? Would you be cool with him getting it off Gunther?
Yeah, but here's the thing, right? WWE and let's not rewrite history. Aside from the fact that I think it was completely unnecessary to have Walter's name changed, but whatever, it is what it is. They have done right by him literally since he came to NXT UK. Like, he got treated exactly the way he should have from jump. People were concerned about him coming up to the main roster, and very quickly were shown that aside from that one kind of weird flat, like, quick out in Survivor Series, that there was nothing to worry about. Gunther's been champion for, you know, he's been champion for 6 months now. And the Intercontinental and U.S. Championships are not typically titles that I think need to have establishing runs mm-hmm. like that. Like, sometimes they do. Sometimes they do. And I think that Gunther has helped, like, kind of steady that ship a little bit. And by metric of him holding it, has helped elevate it back to, like, it feels like a big deal status.
Bobby and Gunther have done a tremendous job of getting those belts back to worker status.
Yes, let's give full marks here to Bobby, who Bobby Lashley did not have a match on this, but lost the U.S. title to Seth Rollins yesterday, or not yesterday, on Raw 2 days ago at time of recording, after Brock Lesnar got involved and accomplished the goal. Like, Seth Rollins needed some fucking gold, time to put that shit on him. But 100%, Bobby helped bring that belt back. Gunther has helped bring that belt back. So if we now move on to Seth Rollins and Sheamus, yeah, I'm all for that. Like, let's make these belts feel like something worthwhile. Absolutely. These have always been the Intercontinental Championship specifically. That belt is a little bit too important to be treated like nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like, Pedro Morales and Pat Patterson and fucking Jericho and The Miz, like, they don't, Honky Tonk Man, they don't bring this belt up to near main event status just for it to, like, you know, be on Shinsuke Nakamura and get defended once in 6 months. Like, that's not what we need from this belt.
And WWE did such a good job a couple of years ago of getting it back up there, you know, like with The Miz and Dolph Ziggler, like, particularly during that run. Like, they really wanted to elevate that title back up to where it was. And then it kind of faltered again, you know? So, Look, it just makes the TV product better. So, and I'm glad, I'm not glad that Bobby lost, but if he's going to face Brock Lesnar, like, not, let's be real, Brock Lesnar ain't going to give a shit about the U.S. belt, but it doesn't have to be a ham-fisted, like, you know, like, Bobby, like, this, even though Bobby lost, for the sole reason that he's going to face Brock Lesnar at Crown Jewel, at least it can breathe a little bit on its own without just him obviously going to lose the belt to Lesnar, you know?
Yeah, and also, like, I miss the days when Brock Lesnar got to be involved in things that didn't have anything to do with a title.
Mm-hmm. This is something we've been clamoring for the last 2 years with him, you know? He's perfectly capable of it.
It feels like 8 years at this point. Yeah, like, literally, since he came back, I can't really think of a single feud he had that didn't involve a title or, like, getting back to a title.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I'm wrong, but I can't recall any of them where, like, he was not champion or getting ready to kill a champion.
Yeah, I don't know if it was him. He doesn't seem like that type of guy. He doesn't give a shit about the belts, but it's good. It's good for the product. He doesn't need it. And let's see what happens.
Let's also give full marks to not just WWE, but Drew McIntyre. First off, I am of the opinion now. So Drew McIntyre finally faces Karrion Kross after Kross is like just getting under him leading up to and following his match with Roman at Clash of the Castle. And they decide to have a good old fashioned strap match, which, you know, AEW helped bring that back. And you know, strap matches are good. When you get a good basic strap match, it's good. A couple things to note here. First off, giving Karrion Kross his elaborate entrance back is what's best for him, because I never fully subscribe to the idea that Karrion Kross, Killer Kross, is just this like bland who gives a shit wrestler. Like, I always thought that was like, I felt like that was because people were upset he was there in NXT beating up their favorites. Like, I never thought it was that big a deal. But putting him in a fucking gimp mask and, you know, removing one of the more interesting things about his presentation didn't do any good for him.
Nah, he's awesome. I love his theme music.
It's great.
They're this year's Royal Rumble should be a little better because I know everybody's
disappointed. Yes, we're finally getting some shit back,
and
right?
Good Lord, I can watch Scarlett Bordeaux just walk around the ring all day.
Yeah, that is the point. The Siren of Sin, they're calling her now. But also, right, so Ryan, after this match, which Karrion Kross won, Ryan texted me and said, so is Drew back to jobbing now? And I disagree with that because I am of the belief that Drew now exists in kind of that, like, Samoa Joe place of a few years ago where, like, Drew is kind of instantly credible whenever you need to heat him up, but also can be somebody that big guys kick the shit out of. And listen, Drew got the shit protected out of him. He got wailed on for like 10 minutes straight on his shoulder. It doesn't matter. And he lost because, like, Scarlett maced the ever-loving shit out of him. So, like, you know, he hardly got embarrassed. Mm-hmm. He just kind of does suffer from weird face in wrestling booking where, like, oh no, the lady's in the ring, I have to stare at her for 5 minutes instead of just like moving past her because I'm three times her size. Like, outside of that, Drew's fine. And if you're really trying to like establish Karrion Kross as someone the crowd should care about, have him go over on Drew McIntyre. He did not do it any form of clean, but he still looks like a monster for like even kind of being able to manhandle Drew. So I thought it worked for both of them, honestly. And I think that the reason maybe it's more maddening is because I truly feel that Drew probably should have won a Clash at the Castle. I didn't feel that way, and then the match happened, and I was like, should have just given it to him.
Yeah.
But regardless, this is how you get Karrion Kross back with the crowd being interested. And then, like, the last three matches, just, like, Bayley-Bianca felt like a ladder match that was one of the more refreshing ladder matches I've seen in a while, where, like, there actually felt like a sense of urgency. Don't get me wrong, there's still some, like, spot setting that's just, like, how ladder matches work, but
you know what it was, too? As soon as, like, this is a ladder match, like, it was good to feel awesome about a ladder match.
There is nothing that can get my dick hard quicker than a good old-fashioned ladder match. not because they were ladies, you fucking perverts. Although it is worth mentioning that Bianca Belair continues to be just the EST of the world. But I think damage control is a really fun faction. Mm-hmm. I think that as long as they continue to treat Io and Dakota as, like, you know, functional wrestlers in their own right, I don't got a problem with Bianca, like, you know, buzzing them off in the middle of this match. Like, it felt like a ladder match where I didn't know what was going to happen, and that's really all I can ever ask for in wrestling. So I'm a fan. I'm cool with it. And then, I don't know, Ryan, I have a hard time deciding what I thought match of the night was between these last two. Because... One second.
I can see Mercury wants to talk about Bound for Glory. Right, Mercury?
You want to talk about Bound for Glory, Mercury? Yeah? That's what you want to do?
Talk about Bobby Fish, Damien.
Bobby Fish. I gotta tell you, I'm having a hard time figuring out whether Finn Edge, the I Quit match, or the Matt Riddle, Seth Rollins Fight Pit match was better. Both of those matches were just fucking great and served really good purposes on their own. I think if you had to make me pick one, I might go the I Quit match because of, like, I think how important that match will become for Judgment Day as a faction.
That was executed really well. When you first heard that was your main I Quit match, you're like, all right, how are they going to do this? Because, you know, you want Finn to win because you want Judgment Day to move forward, naturally
feel important.
The story. How is Edge going to lose, though? And they did it in a very good manner.
First off, this is maybe the most character we've seen from Finn since Bullet Club. This is, like, everything you hoped the continuation of the Prince character in NXT would be and more. Finn has effectively turned Judgment Day into WWE's own Bullet Club. And not only has he been able to regain, like, his character and his sense of, like, Finn finally feels like a fucking big deal again, but also he elevated two people that I didn't think needed the level of elevation that they've gotten, but he has effectively turned Damian Priest, who was already pretty over, into, like, a strong contender for, like, any mid-card belt and someone you can slot into main events when you want. And Judgment Day has made Rhea Ripley into maybe the most over woman in the company.
Definitely getting that good Batista shine when Batista was the enforcer for a little bit. Like, you know what I mean? There's very few guys who become the enforcer and then go past that. Mm-hmm. And Damian Priest, you know, give him some time. I think he's gonna get there.
Yeah. Unlike Dave, you know, he's coming in a little later in his life. Like, at this point, you know, he is, like, 38, but 100%. You know, does he ever get to Batista levels? Not sure.
No.
But I agree that he is an enforcer that feels more than muscle. I also feel that Rhea has done something maybe no woman has done in 30 years or 20 years. And that is, Rhea Ripley has been put into a China-esque role and does not feel like a ripoff of China.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely worth giving aplomb to everybody involved, from Rhea to Triple H to whoever else is involved in creative, because Rhea Ripley went from one of the most promising people in the roster to somebody that was treated well, but we were like, I don't know, why does something feel missing? To, like, Rhea Ripley feels like maybe the only person they have built since China who I would reasonably believe could beat up basically any man on the roster.
And
I don't mean beat, like, many of those women could beat men in a wrestling match. Rhea Ripley and Bianca Belair feel like the only two people that could beat up anybody on that roster for the most part.
Yeah, Dominic slowly morphing into Eddie too is pretty. It's pretty cool.
Dominic desperately needed anything to grab hold of, and sometimes the most effective medicine is a good old fashioned heel turn on Poppy.
And you know, I'm not saying totally adapt the Latin flair that Eddie Guerrero had, but I would just lock him in a room for a weekend with just a bunch of Eddie Guerrero tapes and just be like, I mean, like, what the fuck do I know? He was legitimately the kid's like godfather, but still, like, don't come out until you have this down pat, because I want that match between whenever it comes between him and Ray. I want it to fucking slap. I want this kid to carry the Mysterio name for the next 20 years. I legitimately like him. He came into WWE as like this meek, quiet guy, and maybe for the long run, that's going to be fucking awesome when we look back on it. Like, yo, this was this guy. But, you know, I think this is a perfect role for him to come into.
Ray has long said that it would bring him no end of joy to like have his last match be like against Dom. And I think we're really getting to that point where, you know, that and so the one thing I'll say is like the feud feels like it's gone on forever, but this I Quit match has now really helped move it into a different place.
Oh shit, territory.
Where Judgment Day feels fucking big, and now give this just a little bit more time, and Dom and Rey as a WrestleMania match feels 100%.
Oh, that's
like,
gonna hurt,
deserved.
Man. That's gonna hurt to finally close the book on Rey Mysterio. You know, because like it by all accounts, it probably should have been closed, but because the man is a fucking legend, like he just still keeps going. But like,
and a freak.
You know, it's a chapter in our wrestling fandom that, you know, it's finally gonna come to a close.
And also, and I said this to Ryan, but like, Edge and Hangman Adam Page are the two best actors in wrestling. You know what? And I'll amend that. Edge, Hangman Adam Page, MJF, Jay White. That's my like top four of like, these are the best actors in professional wrestling. Not only does an I Quit match, you know, when you have two people that understand what makes I Quit matches good, you know, it works. Like, once you're in a similar place to, like, the infamous, I say infamous, and then I'm immediately going to forget the other guy's name, but the Tully Blanchard I Quit match against what's-his-face.
Nabisco?
No. The fuck was the match? Stupid. Stupid. Don't bring something up if you don't know about it. Magnum TA.
Oh, okay. I would have...
The Magnum TA Starrcade 85 match.
I gotta rewatch that.
Arguably the greatest I Quit match of all time. Like, a good I Quit match needs two people that fucking hate each other, that refuse to give in until they have no choice. Both Edge and Finn sold that outstandingly. Involving Beth was a real, like, Beth looks strong. And Rhea looks like an absolute fucking killer. And like, just the visual, the visual of Rhea just like looking over at Edge with a chair after knocking out Beth, her lying there unconscious, and Finn and Damian Priest and Dom just holding Edge, and Finn just going, "It's your last chance. It's your last chance." Says, "I quit." Rhea goes, "Of course you do." Hits him anyway. Like, you have officially solidified that group as like, potentially, like, now you have the bloodline, and you follow this up properly, and the Judgment Day will be arguably your biggest heel faction.
Now I gotta watch Edge versus Mick Foley. I quit.
Again, when you have two people that understand what these matches are supposed to be, mm-hmm. It works on every level. And Edge's acting after Beth gets hit is just like, now we don't know where Edge goes. Is this Edge's way of taking some time off and then we let the story simmer and come back? Does Edge lose his mind again? You know, who knows? Mm-hmm. Who knows what happens? So then the last match of Extreme Rules, Matt Riddle versus Seth Rollins. This has again been just an outstanding feud. Having Daniel Cormier as ref after referencing his thing with, who was it that he did that with? John Jones? Was it John Jones? Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, just a great match. And honestly, unique. I've never seen like a fight pit match
before. I love me a steel cage, but if you do this more often, fine with that.
So it looks like the first time it ever happened was between Matt Riddle and Timothy Thatcher. So Matt Riddle is now the king of the fight pit mm-hmm. match. But You know, the little ledge above the ring, very cool. And again, just like, this is a feud that has worked, and this was the blow-off match, and Riddle goes over. And just like a really great hard-hitting match. And Seth Rollins is also kind of in that same place of Drew McIntyre, where like no loss will ever really...
Well, especially not just not immediately now. Getting the title the next night. Yeah. Yeah.
It doesn't matter that he got it clean.
That's
clean.
Seth,
it doesn't matter.
You know?
That's Seth, baby. This is the first time, I think, since... I don't... 2016? It's like the first time in many years where Moxley, Roman, and Seth all had belts at the same time.
Oh, yeah.
And then, of course, at the end, we finally get the big reveal of what has probably been the most creative thing WWE has done in a very long time. They finally reveal the White Rabbit, all of these QR codes and weird subliminals happening throughout the matches and throughout the last couple of weeks and months on Twitter, on Raw, on SmackDown. And he had the whole world in his hands the whole time. The long-awaited return of Bray Wyatt, the Funhouse abandoned, the characters out in the wild, and Bray... We don't know what Bray is now. He could be a mixture of Funhouse Bray and The Fiend Bray and Cult Leader Bray, or he could be something different altogether. But look, at the end of the day, WWE is better when Bray Wyatt gets to do his thing.
I love how it was so painfully obvious that it was going to be him, but it took until they uttered the words, he's got the whole world in his hands, for it to finally be... solidified, and then it was just like the roller coaster drop. You're like, here we fucking go. And I took mighty good edibles before that, and just like this, the ta 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 ta, like zoom into the characters, dude, as the fucking music is playing. Perfect.
You know what was great about the whole thing though was like these QR codes and these like subliminals. They also referenced everything from Karrion Kross to Malakai Black to Cody. Like, they referenced a bunch of people that you were like, oh shit, like a lot of it for a long time felt like it was talking about Edge before he came back. So like, they did a really good job of making what was obvious feel a little bit like there was a point where people were like, oh fuck, this is definitely Edge, because it was referencing all things like that
Charlotte Flair at some point, people
Charlotte
were saying.
Flair, like, it started referencing a lot of things where people were like, I guess I don't know anymore what this is.
One of the coolest ones was S0713 or S07EP13, and it took you to a Simpsons episode where White Rabbit was playing.
Yes. And they did it by like in between matches or house matches. They just played White Rabbit on the speakers. Like, it just was very well done. Apparently, the company that was responsible for it, I think, did like Marble Hornets, which is what like got Slenderman into vogue. So,
oh my God, geez, they really went all out for this.
Yeah, it was like a big thing. And then, you know, Raw just. Brock Lesnar coming back, having a non-title feud, Seth with a belt, and on SmackDown's place, Sami Zayn helping the Bloodline become interesting again.
Yeet.
Sami becoming a member of the Bloodline that Jey Uso hates, that Roman has some weird soft spot for, is like a very funny, interesting thing, and like, sure, I'm here for it. Why not? Him calling Logan Paul the biggest number two in the planet. Very funny. Look, man, I'm not going to start watching Raw. I don't have 3 hours to dedicate on Mondays.
What do you mean?
But, like,
what do you mean?
But,
fuck the city. Spend 3 hours.
WWE is doing its very best to convince people like me that, like, maybe there's some hope for it. It's also still like a trash billion-dollar company, and fuck everybody involved in it. But you know, whatever.
Well, the non-doomer approach, they're sailing quite well. And you know, it's funny. Like, AEW could be as perfect as it is, but as soon as you get like that air of like the prototypical promo in WWE, you know what I'm talking about? Like, it just feels like like the glove fitting, like, you know what I mean? And listen, like, man, no matter what other company comes out, and if they do arguably more successful than WWE, you're never going to take that away.
The reality is, as we've said a thousand times, the wrestling world is better when there are options for wrestlers.
Yep.
And it's clear that, like, that's where Moxley and Jericho approach AEW. And, you know, I do hope that Ring of Honor gets a TV deal and gets to be its own thing again. Impact continues to toil away doing its thing. Apparently, Bound for Glory, the match between Josh Alexander and Eddie Edwards was very good. You know, the New Japan, we're spiraling towards Wrestle Kingdom. We got the Junior Tag and World Tag League coming up. The main event is solidified. It's going to be Jay White versus Okada again for the IWGP World Heavyweight Championship. Will Ospreay doing his very best to make the U.S. title feel relevant. Also, the Good Brothers are back in WWE, while Carl Anderson is still never open weight champion. And while WWE did not mention that, New Japan retweeted the video on Raw. Jay White talked about it. So, like, is there some sort of, like, loose agreement between New Japan and WWE now that, you know, Triple H is in charge? Have they decided that they're going to open their doors to whatever American company wants to work with them? I don't know. We'll see if it means anything, but Carl Anderson says that he is still planning to defend the Never Open Weight Championship against Hikuleo and possibly against Tama Tonga at Wrestle Kingdom. So, you know, it's, the world is better when there are options for wrestlers. And that's all there really is to it.
Who are some of your top young lions that are going to be on the scene in the coming year?
Okay, so look, Alex Coughlin is out fucking outrageously good, and I cannot wait for him to, like, properly enter New Japan. They've done a great job with Clark Connors as the Wild Rhino in the junior division. Really looking forward to him. Wouldn't call him a young lion, but adding Francesco Akira to the United Empire from All Japan and putting him in the junior division is great. Again, not a young lion, but Titan has joined LIJ. He's the first person to join LIJ since Shingo in, I think, 2018, and is the first Gaijin to join the faction. So that's a big deal. From a young lion perspective, Ren Narita is going to be a fucking star. Yota Tsuji and Yuya Uemura are going to be fucking stars. I still have hope for Alex Fredericks, but we will see what happens with him. He's not been in a great place. And Gabriel Kidd, who had like a huge mental breakdown, appears to be back in New Japan, appears to be back in good graces, and he's absurdly talented as well. So if he is in fact back in the fold, very high hopes for him. And at some point, we're going to be getting Shota Umino back. We're going to be getting Shota Umino back, Red Shoes' son, who has a big Tanahashi flair to him. So we've got a lot of people that should be coming back pretty soon. And New Japan seems like they're more open to bringing in younger guys in as well. And, you know, I think the future is really bright for them if they continue to develop those folks. So, you know, New Japan, it's doing its thing. We're still only getting half crowd capacity shows, or, you know, we're not getting full cheering yet. It is a slow, arduous crawl at this point.
I thought I read a report that they were close, unless they nixed it.
No one knows, because it's like they can do cheering if it's 50% capacity, but New Japan desperately needs the money, so they can't really afford to do that.
Yeah.
If it's like Osaka, the Osaka crowds kind of do whatever they want.
Are they like the southern crowd here?
They're like the Chicago, basically, where like I think they got called like, I think it was called like the Scourge of Osaka, because like they had a baseball game and like the crowd went fucking nuts, and everyone was like, no, bad Osaka.
Well, if only their government gave up on COVID like we did.
Yeah, get with the times, guys. But once New Japan can get full gates and full cheering back, which I desperately hope happens in time for Wrestle Kingdom, then they're going to be doing just fine. You know, Noah trudging along, getting ready for Keiji Muto to show up, who, you know, fucking Keiji Muto showed up at Grand Slam. Didn't even talk about that. Great fucking Muta showed up, teamed up with Sting. Sting's going to be involved in Great Muta's last match in Japan. I don't know the last time Sting was in Japan. 40 years ago, maybe? Yeah. Like, the wrestling world is wide. It's got a lot happening. And if AEW can weather this storm and WWE gets back to being entertaining creatively and we get Ring of Honor back on TV and Impact keeps doing its thing, the indies continue to thrive, then we're going to be doing just fine. Let the golden age resume.
Yeah, I'm excited for the next year in New Japan, especially that, especially Wrestle Kingdom, like just around the corner too.
That's so exciting. Best time of the year next to G1 season. So, you know, Wrestle Kingdom coming up in January. Big WWE pay-per-views. Let's see, what do we got coming up? What do we got? The Rumble's in January, so that's Wrestle Kingdom season. So what do we got for the rest of the year for WWE? What's
Survivor Series? And then, I don't know, did they get rid of TLC? I thought they did.
Maybe. But obviously for AEW, Full Gear is going to be, I think, somewhere around November 10th or some shit.
November 4th.
November 4th.
Mm-hmm.
So we're getting to the fun part of the year, you know. And if WWE has this level of momentum going into the Rumble and, you know, leading up to Mania with Wrestle Kingdom and hopefully the return of cheering crowds and AEW getting the belt on MJF and getting itself back on track, then I think we're going to be sitting really pretty for an outstanding year of wrestling until the next fucking plague.
Oh, you know what? They eliminated the December pay-per-view entirely, and what they do now is that Crown Jewel is going to be on November 5th, if you want to count that. And then Thanksgiving weekend, I think? Yes, Thanksgiving weekend will be Survivor Series, and then day one will be the next pay-per-view after that.
No December to dismember, Ryan? No December to dismember?
Have you... Oh, my God. Dude, the arena that they ran that pay-per-view at is, like, the shittiest arena ever. We have to like, watch that in full. Like, a watch-along or something like that.
Yeah, Waka Waka. December to dismember, 1990.
The James Brown Arena.
In 1995... Public Enemy, the Pitbulls, and Tommy Dreamer versus the Heavenly Bodies, the Eliminators, Raven and Stevie Richards in an Ultimate Jeopardy steel cage match. And then, of course, in 2006, Big Show versus Bobby Lashley versus Rob Van Dam versus CM Punk versus Hardcore Holly versus Test in an Extreme Elimination Chamber match for the ECW Championship.
Oh, my goodness. And it sucked, too, because, you know, I mean, it was kind of like dead in the water at this point, but... Man, when ECW was announced back, it was going to be awesome. And then...
ECWWE did not do well.
Stevie Richards killed his whole family, so that really killed the momentum of things.
There goes that.
But, you know, like, when they first, like, drew the lines and, like, Kurt Angle, it was, like, Big Show and Stevie Richards versus Kurt Angle, and then, like, Big Show and Kurt Angle turned on the WWE people. And then they revealed the ECW shirts, and you're like, wow, they're really building a roster for this. And then literally like 2 weeks later, all that shit happened. And I was like, okay, that's the end of that. But, you know, I think if they really did Shane's idea with it, it could have been NXT.
So are we just
are we retconning? Yeah, we're going to retcon.
We're just deciding from now on that that's Stevie Richards.
Yeah, but he came back and he wrestled.
Right. And he's like fine now.
He's fine now.
Okay. Okay, good. Good to know. All right, so as we wrap up, Ryan, it is spooky season. Mm-hmm. So I'm not interested in what you're listening to. I'm interested in what are you watching to?
Ooh, I just started What We Do in the Shadows with Kelly. And
you know, we just
what a
started
fucking
that
fantastic
well.
Show. I cannot believe...
Oh, so good.
I can't believe I waited this long to start watching it.
Taika Waititi knows what he's doing, man.
Oh man, dude, that just straight hits with that guy, man. Even Our Flag Means Death has been cheekily fun.
I do want to watch that. Yeah, we started watching What We Do in the Shadows as well. We picked like a trifecta of spooky shows. Mm-hmm. We're watching that, Yellow Jackets, which is on Stars.
I have to get into that, especially since I'm a huge 90s rock fan.
Big on that. And then what is the other one we're watching that's spooky? Fuck. Severance.
Yo, I heard that. I don't have Apple TV, but I heard that was really good, especially the ending. I heard was phenomenal. I don't know if you got to it yet.
We haven't watched yet because Gina heard that it was like a huge cliffhanger, so we're trying to watch it very slowly until season two.
That's awesome.
But are we indulging in any spooktastic movies?
Yes, so I watched Barbarian.
Oh, that's going to be on online soon, right? Yep. Or is it already?
I don't know.
How was it?
Amazing. And if you're into that type of stuff, it clicks all the boxes.
It was called this year's Malignant. Does that seem accurate?
Mm-hmm. Pearl was a great movie that I saw.
Pearl?
T. West, I believe is his name. West?
Yeah, yeah.
It is a prequel to X, which came out last year, too. So.
Oh, Gina was telling me about that one, right.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we're going to do the run of the standards. You know, we're going to put on Don't Worry, Darling. And Avatar. That's going to be a good spooky one. And
Avatar?
Brad Pitt's face melting in Bullet Train.
Oh, I should watch that. We've been delving into the classics, Gina.
No, I was just kidding, by the way. You know, I don't think Don't Worry, Darling is a horror movie.
Well, too bad. Now it's on the list.
Okay.
Gina's been listening to this podcast called Filthy Fucking Casuals. No, she doesn't listen to the product. Gina's been listening to this podcast called Blank Check, which is like a bunch of movie buffs who, like, I think are involved in UCB.
Mm-hmm.
And they like go through directors' entire filmographies. So they did like M. Night Shyamalan Ding Dong and
that's cool.
And James Cameron and Cameron Crowe and I think John Carpenter and other people.
Carpenter.
So we've been hitting up some of the classics that she has not watched. Like we watched Terminator and T2, which Judgment Day, mm-hmm. outstanding movie. Terminator, I would argue, is more of a horror movie than an action movie, honestly, because Arnold just plays an unstoppable killing machine that like they don't present it in an action way. It's more like that whole scene in the police precinct is like very horror adjacent.
It's very dystopian horror as opposed to an action film. It's only an action film because Schwarzenegger is in it, you know?
Yeah, T2, sure. T2 is 100% an action film, but Terminator 1 is a real, like, mm-hmm. that feels like sci-fi horror. Watch the first Friday the 13th, which, here's a fun fact, speaking of, not actually saying that. What, in fact, the actor is saying is, mama, because he's saying, it's like kill and mommy.
Ah, there we go. Kevin Bacon.
Kevin Bacon, young Kevin Bacon. We watched Aliens, outstanding.
The second one?
Yeah, the second one. James Cameron's.
You know what's fucking crazy, man? 1, 2, and 3 take place in the span of 48 hours or something like that.
Well, I mean, 1 and 2 are separated by like 50-something years.
Okay, never mind. Is it 2, 3, 4? Something like, I don't know.
Well, keep in mind that for Ridley, as far as she's concerned, it's probably like 2 days because she like goes into cryo sleep at the end of 1, but in actual time it's like 50 something years because then the home world is like colonized and shit. Outstanding movie. I started watching The Midnight Club, Mike Flanagan's new show on Netflix. Good spooky fun. It's kind of like a mix between Are You Afraid of the Dark and like kind of like Midnight Mass. It's like a good like thriller.
Did you watch Prometheus?
Yes, I don't hate it as much as everyone else did.
I didn't hate it. I really liked it. You know, I wasn't expecting it to be a full alien movie, but I thought it did the job.
Yeah, and I thought that, what is the movie that, what alien movie was it that came after that? Was that like Resurrection or something?
Yes.
I forgot what it was called.
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was like not as good, but also fine. But Prometheus is a good time. I think it's a good time movie. But we've got our spooky list happening here. You know, I want to see Nope and Barbarian and got to see some of the classics. So, you know.
I want to watch Nosferatu. I haven't watched that in a minute.
I might watch some of the old classics just to say fuck it. I've never watched them as well.
I recommend this to anybody. Like, a lot of those movies are just on YouTube. So I remember a couple of years ago, we streamed some like old like Hitchcock movies through the projector.
Mm-hmm.
Old like
Rear Window and shit.
Yeah. So it's pretty cool.
A lot of those are now on Peacock and HBO, because I forget which one of those is Universal, but it's like, I think it's Peacock, like classic monsters. Mm-hmm. So like Frank and Peacock's like Halloween selection, like they're the way that they have it organized is really fucking good. So
yeah, that's where me and Kelly watched a lot of like Friday movies and shit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So Ryan, as we wrap up, do we have a legend killer for Papa?
Let me prepare it. Oh, have you ever seen Dementia 13?
No.
So Dementia 13 was like Francis Coppola's like first movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting.
I'll tell you what I did watch in the last year, Eraserhead. And let me tell you something. Gina has never hated any one thing, including possibly misogyny or racism, as much as she hates Eraserhead.
Yeah.
She gets violently angry at the mention of that movie. If you want a fucking horror film to end all horror films, though, you got to go watch you like Grave Encounters or Hell House LLC, because those are fucking crazy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Eraserhead, man. Jeez.
Yeah, that's a hell of a movie. All right. So first things first, who am I paying attention to in this?
You got picture? Three wrestlers in this picture.
I got three wrestlers in this picture. Is it all three of the kids?
No.
It's the guy and two of the kids.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. Well, you shouldn't be this hard, but obviously you are. Okay. What age range are we looking like? This looks like it's like late 80s, 90s.
I don't know the exact year of this picture. I would say it's about 92. Maybe
92?
Maybe 90. You know what? Maybe a little later. This may be like 94.
Is one of them Stevie Richards?
This is like if we took a family picture, like you know, around us. Yeah.
So one of them is Stevie Richards?
Yes, one of them is Stevie Richards. The other one is Stevie Richards Jr. And the other one is Stevie Richards Jr. Jr.
Oh, very good. Stevie Jr. Jr.,
yes,
as it were. Okay, well, like, obviously this shouldn't be that difficult, but this face has given me a real blank right now.
Which one?
Like, Dad?
You know, I wouldn't expect you to get Dad off the bat, but Dad will make a little more sense if you figure out the two youngins.
Okay, so if this is 92 and these kids got to be like 5 or 6, so they're like 5 years older than me, so we're looking like mid-30s at this point. Mid-30s, brothers. Is this CPA Bray and Bo?
IRS Bray and Bo, but yes, correct.
IRS, goddammit.
Good job. And I'll give you a little bonus point. The woman is part of a famous wrestling family herself.
Huh. I always confuse CPA with IRS, and CPA is like a current indie wrestler, so that's like extremely silly.
Yeah, isn't he in Creative Pro?
He's in Creative Pro.
Nice.
I always fucking...
Oh, shit. Was he wearing a...
He wears a suit.
But was he wearing a dress shirt with a tie, and then he fucking...
Yes.
Yeah, oh, God, that was great.
Yeah, that's
I'll
that's
fucking
CPA.
Mark for that.
Who did IRS marry, though? You know, that totally does look like Bray.
The key
like
is now. In Bray's name. Yeah, it does look like Bray, right? I didn't want to be like, just focus on the kid in the middle, but...
like in the name Bray Wyatt?
His real name.
Rotunda?
First name.
Wyndham?
Yeah.
Is it Barry Wyndham's
sister?
Something?
Yep.
Sister?
Yep. And then their grandfather was Blackjack Mulligan.
Blackjack Mulligan, that yeah. I knew. I did not so bad.
You did pretty good.
Did pretty good. Yeah, I don't think I've ever seen IRS outside of like a suit and glasses. So, like, yeah, right? I don't think I've ever seen an IRS match.
It was like a couple years ago. They had like a Legends briefcase match, and then he won, and then immediately Ted DiBiase came out, and then he just handed the briefcase to Ted DiBiase because everybody has a price. And apparently that price is all the welfare money in Mississippi.
Hashtag Brett Favre. All right. Outstanding. Outstanding stuff. I got the Legend Killer. We're doing things.
Imagine Bray Wyatt stumbling onto our Instagram and be like, why is my family picture?
Not loving this. Not loving this at all. I bought that shirt. That shirt is sick. The fucking upside down moth. Thing.
Is that a reference to something?
I don't know. Probably. Maybe. I noticed that when Karrion Kross came out, it was on the screen, and at first I thought it was his thing. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the broadcast, I was like, oh, because they were doing that like the whole night. They were just like throwing his shit.
Oh, that's cool. I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, like they like it at one point, like the White Rabbit like interrupted the feed. At another point, like that showed up in Karrion Kross's LED. Like, they did a very good job with this overall.
You know, it's funny. So, there have been rumors that Chelsea Green is being pursued by WWE again. So, by proxy, of course, whether or not he wants to go back. Not that it really needs him anymore. Matt Cardona has been talked about going back too. So, he's just been trolling all day and posting like old pictures of him as Zack Ryder. And then there's one picture of him when he's just like internet champion. And on his trunks, in the front of the trunks by the Peugeot, is a QR code. And some kid commented, like, dude, the QR code doesn't lead to anything, Bray Wyatt. He's like, dude, I did this fucking 15 years ago. And it just goes to show, like, fucking...
I hope Matt Cardona never goes back because Matt... Not because, like, fuck WWE or FedBad or whatever, but because, like, Matt Cardona's story of just, like, indie triumph is legitimately inspiring to me, and I just, like, hope that sticks around forever.
Yeah, I had this conversation with Tony. It was just like, he doesn't need to go back, does he? And he goes, absolutely not.
No, he's perfectly fine. He can show up wherever, do whatever. He's been NWA champion, GCW champion. He can go to Impact. Let him do whatever the fuck he wants. Like, if he comes back and he were to be Zack Ryder, you know, woo, woo, woo. But outside of that, whatever.
He ultimately said, he's like, look, I don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, am I going to say no to a WrestleMania match? Absolutely not. So,
of course he wouldn't. I heard that Chelsea Green pitched herself to be a sexy nun for Seth Rollins' Messiah character, as well as a human embodiment of Lily when Alexa Bliss was doing that.
Interesting.
So there's some tidbits for you. All right. So that's what we got here. A clean standard hour 40 episode for everybody. You're welcome.
We're back.
We're back, baby. Until 3 months from now.
3 months later. Sorry about that, folks. It's had a little bit of a...
Damien lost his mind again.
Or me. I mean, you can easily say me.
Yeah, but it's going to be me.
That's like, it's going to be me. I don't feel like doing it this week. Oh, that's okay, pal. I'll do it next week.
So, for Ryan, for myself, this has been the most electrifying must-listen-to podcast in sports entertainment. This has been FFC.
Listen to Jell.